when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, a podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel bad about. I'm your host, Karen Donahue, and there's gotta be more to life than making out. Joining me is the author who is doing it for his country, Seamus O'Reilly.
Hello.
You owe it to your country.
I do. I really do think there is more to life than making out. I just want that to be clear up top. But 2 hours, you can feel like there is little else.
There's little else. Everything in the film Grease 2 revolves around who is making out.
It's one of the horniest movies that's ever been made.
Tell me why you chose this today.
Well, considering I've just described it as one of the horniest movies.
Because I'm a horny man with horny thoughts.
Well, astonishingly, we had that weird, chaste affection for it in my family. So to set it up, Grease 2 is one of those movies in our family. My very large family, about which I've written, where we watched the video of this so many times that we convinced ourselves that it was a sort of a blockbuster, a classic. It was one of those movies that just everyone had seen. It was like Jaws or Star Wars or something. Or Grease 1.
Yeah.
You know, but I was messaging with my family and just this week, and I was asked, how many times do you think we watched it? And they were like, must have been easily hundreds. Because we would watch it sometimes twice a weekend, and then on the summer holidays you'd watch it maybe every 2 or 3 days. And it was in this weird roll call, because we grew up way out in the sticks on the Derry Donegal border. We didn't have a Blockbuster or an X-Division anywhere near us, but my dad taped 800 films off the TV, mm-hmm. kept them all in the garage, all itemised and numbered. He did up a brochure on a very early sort of database program, and quite grandly he would put in the name, the stars, but then he'd also put in like the rating that he'd given it himself.
Oh no, my God!
I don't mean like 5 stars. I mean like 18, 12, PG.
But I thought your dad was like his own Roger Ebert.
That would have been the icing on the cake. I mean, he did weirder stuff than that. For example, he would say how long it was and how long was left on the tape so that he could always go back and use it. I mean, this is a guy.
That's very pragmatic.
Very much. But he also would use that to create sort of mind-bending double bills. So some of the tapes, obviously, you could get 2 films on, which was like, you know, a thrill for my dad because it meant he was saving a tape.
Yeah.
Which meant that sometimes you'd have double bills that made sense. Like, I think Beverly Hills Cop and the Muppet Movie are together, I think, which is a pretty good one.
Tonally, I feel like they bop along at the same beat.
Yes, but they also had ones like Highlander and Pride and Prejudice were on the same tape. and A Woman's Heart, a performance of the RTE Woman's Heart thing with Eleanor McAvoy and Sharon Shannon and all these sort of Irish folk music with a female slant was on the same tape as Robocop. So you'd need to be in a very specific mood. But because we were feckless children who just sat and watched whatever was in front of us, we would watch both back to back.
Yeah.
You know, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang was on the same tape as, I think, the last third of Ben-Hur. So we would watch.
A better ending for Ben-Hur, I think.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
A fantastical twist into Dr. Caruso's
We had Police Academy 4 followed by Police Academy 2 on one tape. So that's 2 terrible films out of order without the film that's actually in the middle. So like that could genuinely be used as like CIA torture, I think, having to watch that.
I genuinely worry for children now for many reasons, but chiefly because they're not forced to watch the same things over and over again because of endless content, etc. How do you form a sort of idiosyncratic personality if not based on the shit lying around your house?
I suppose it's your parents trying to make you like cool things. Like, I'm constantly trying to get my son to listen to sort of abstruse electronic music, but he wants to listen to The Wiggles.
So of all the tapes that you had lying around, like Ben-Hur and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and A Woman's Heart, why is it that Grease 2 like lodged so firmly like shrapnel in your heart?
Well, we really loved Grease as well. It wasn't, but most of us, I think, as kids, might have told you that Grease 2 was our favourite. And I think it's because of the disparity between our love for it, which was very, you know, very real, and the fact that whenever we went into the wider world, like, you know, people who'd been trapped in a nuclear bunker for 40 years and realised that nobody else, if they had seen it, they hated it, and most people just hadn't seen it, or maybe had seen it once. It was never on TV, obviously, apart from the time that my dad taped it. So it was just, it had no cultural impact whatsoever. And it was like, it was weird. It was like, you know, a sort of slightly more engaging version of that film Yesterday by Richard Curtis, where you walk up and you wake up and no one's heard of Grease 2. And I'm like, maybe I could
imagine the millions you could make
by doing it for my country.
I know.
So that it's that disparity, because there were other movies that had that same effect. Brewster's Millions, which and Overboard, which are kind of movies that people...
Overboard's a great movie.
Absolutely. And they're movies that people have heard of. But in our house, they were like Empire Strikes Back and, you know, a Marvel movie. They were huge.
Yeah.
You know, they were like in the top five, obviously the top five best-selling films of all time. They must be. Because we watched them so much, and they were so, like, there are still, like, I haven't seen Grease 2 in 20 years until I watched them again. And I still knew almost all of it off by hand. Like, I have people that I work with on a fairly regular basis whose faces and names I can't remember. Like, before, I had to go back to my house on the way here because I'd forgotten my wallet and my phone. Like, I can still remember every single thing in this film, which is not to say that I didn't have quite a few revelations watching it, I think, for the first time as an adult.
That was my next question. So when you rewatched it for the purposes of this podcast, what was anything that surprised you?
Just how horny it was. Because I've mentioned this to people before, that like this was like such a sort of monumental film in our family, like cinematic library. And also we'd laugh about, geez, it was so horny, and that song in the bunker, and the fact that they're all just talking about, you know, kind of scoring all the time. But it's really, really, like, shocked me. Just, it's every single scene, and it's every single motivation of every single character. And it's also endlessly rewarded. There's not really a... It's no one's set up for a fall by being so horny. It's like, no, that's just what's driving this story, because, hey, it's good to be horny, and these guys are, you know, tip-top at it.
True. It's a very shame-free environment, is Grease 2.
Yeah. I suppose, yeah, people get dunked in water and like this sort of like...
The only crime there is in the Grease universe is being a square.
That is, oh my God, I hate squares.
Oh my God, dunk on the squares. But I had never seen this film until you made me watch it. And but my experience of it has been that once every 6 years, I find out that there's somebody in my life very close to me who feels very passionately about this film.
I'm so happy to hear it.
I know. So the weird thing is, my next question was, is this a Northern Irish thing? Because I have, years and years and years ago, long before I moved to London, I had a Donegal ex, who's then boyfriend, who was obsessed with it to the point where he called me Stephanie Zanoni all the time.
That's the greatest,
greatest compliment. So obviously I'm with a lovely man now and have been for many years, and I hope to be for many years, but I kind of want to go back in time and kiss my old Donegal boyfriend.
Do you want to turn back?
The greatest compliment I've ever received from a man, and it's only now, like 15 years later, I can understand what a compliment
it was. I can't believe you didn't immediately watch the... I mean, we're going to get to Stephanie Zanoni, because...
Let's get to all of it. Yeah, wow.
Do we need to give a bit of a setup to people who've not seen
Grease 2? Here's the plot summary coming in hot. All right. Grease 2 returns to Rydell High in 1961 with a new class of T-Birds and Pink Ladies. The Pink Ladies are ruled by Stephanie Zanoni, who is starting to get sick of her long-term boyfriend, Johnny Nagiarelli. Made-up sounding Italian names, a big stalwart in Grease 2. Stephanie quickly catches the eye of an English exchange student, Michael Carrington, and hoping to win her over, Michael tries to overcome his quote-unquote nerdy ways.
Nerd.
Nerd. So yeah, it's basically a gender-flipped Grease where it's a bad girl versus a square guy. But there's really nothing to recommend what is so square about Michael Carrington. He's the most beautiful young man I've ever seen.
I mean, he's got like those sort of big milky movie star eyes. His skin, you know, makes you want to throw yourself in front of a bus. I mean,
they could have at least put glasses on him, you know? They don't even want to commit to the fact that he's undesirable. He's the most beautiful man ever, and what makes him nerdy is that he's English and he knows who Shakespeare
also,
is.
Also, it's kind of subverting the whole trope that, I mean, you see again and again in American culture where automatically, as someone with a sort of middle to posh English accent is kind of endlessly attractive to these kind of, you know, colonial squares kind of thing.
Rydell High are in the rare.
I mean, you mentioned Stephanie Sinone. I think I just have to... I had such a crush on Stephanie Sinone. You know one of those like pre-sexual crushes you have where it's like, I don't know what it is, but wow. She was just the dreamiest of the dreamiest. And obviously, I didn't get that whole thing where I'd go back and say, wow, she really was dreamy, because it's Michelle Pfeiffer. We know that Michelle Pfeiffer is extremely dreamy.
Yeah.
But even still, I'm like... Wow.
She sort of breaks the camera when she enters. it's that whole musical number where it's back to school and we're meeting all the characters and it's a very standard musical number. It's really well choreographed. It's really fun. And then she just walks in off the bus with the fucking blonde hair and the sunglasses and the pink lady's jacket. No one's ever been cooler or hotter. It like her face.
It's mathematically perfect. It's like a cruel joke how beautiful she is.
It's almost. Cruel. It's a cruel joke. It's like, you know those early PlayStation renderings of Lara Croft and her face is so pointy? It's that the jagged points to her face that almost shouldn't be beautiful because they're so hard.
Yeah.
But then there's these big eyes and it doesn't make sense.
And also, she's got to do a lot of the heavy lifting in the film. And she's Michelle Pfeiffer good at acting as well. Like, you know, we know that Michelle Pfeiffer is also a very good actress. So, like, she holds, I mean... It's not a great amount of work to have to... It's not a great role to do so much work with, but you really believe her whenever she's saying these hammy lines about being unhappy. I mean, her main problem in life is that she wants to have sex with someone who has a motorbike.
That's her main thing.
That's it. It's no dope deeper than that. Like,
the thing I could not understand about Stephanie Zanoni is, as much as I loved her instantly and will follow her to the end of the earth, is that at some point over the summer she had some kind of existential crisis, which means she no longer wants to be with Johnny Nasirelli.
Yeah, I mean, we all get to that stage with Johnny every once in a while.
We do. And so she wants to throw off the shackles of the T-Birds, but she's throwing off the shackles of the T-Birds by having... She has to have someone exactly like them.
Yeah, well, by the way, if anyone hasn't seen the original Grease by some miracle, like the same sort of feudal tithing of concubines is in place where the T-Birds and the Pink Ladies, they're not just pals. They are exclusively in a relationship tract where a T-Bird can only ever go out with a Pink Lady and vice versa, which apart from being just completely mental anyway, also... When they break up, you've got like one spare T-Bird. Like, what do you do? I mean, in a social system which is entirely predicated on horniness, it's a hornocracy. Does Johnny Nasirelli have to go to like the Pink Lady Committee and say, "I'm afraid you have to get another member because," or one of my fellow T-Birds is going to have to, you know, dump his Pink Lady, so that I mean, it's just completely bananas.
Because my understanding of the first Grease was, that they're just like, you know, two gangs who like getting jackets printed and they hang out and they have a good time and some of them date. But in Grease 2, they are specifically a harem, a mutually dependent harem for each other.
Yeah, it's a zero sum game. It's a zero snog game. You have to, you can't exit the system.
Yeah.
Or, you know, without consequences. Like, when Stephanie Zanoni, our dearest, dearest, dearest pal, she has a little flirty moment with Michael, who in Incognito, as a guy that we'll get to, the Cool Rider. It's an amazing name. Even without the obvious Irish double connotation of the term rider. But they're so incensed by this, explicitly because he's not a T-Bird, that they chase him to what they presume is his death. So it actually does have martial significance. Like, you can actually be killed because you're exiting the T-Bird Pink Lady axis of snogging.
Yeah, yeah. There seems to be very few rewards for being within the T-Bird Pink Lady nexus.
Yeah. Although
because they don't even get laid.
And also there's this sort of weird... sort of aristocratic sort of fluffing that the other members of the T-Birds have to do to whoever is the leader.
Yeah.
Which is really weird. And they're all...
Which that democratic process is never revealed.
It's, no, it's never. But like they all just kind of stand to his side and like big him up. Mm. It's very dignity phobic.
I think it's dignity phobic.
Yeah, like that could never happen in an Irish school. Like we didn't even have like a... I used to always think that when I'd watch things as a kid, like Homecoming Queen and King and Queen and all that, or, you know, the Lady of the Dance, you know, whatever they... Like,
yeah.
Like, as if that
as
would happen.
Imagine.
Like, well, I'm going to say who the best person in our year is? Absolutely not. We're just way, way too cynical. Like, are you completely bananas? Like,
Yeah, the notion of electing one of your peers and saying they're better, like the tallest poppy thing of Ireland would never allow for it. That person would be murdered the next
day. How dribblesomely complacent would you have to be in your life that you would want the success of anyone? Well, not quite, but you know, especially at 16 or 17, you're like, oh, it was never expressed en masse. Oh, that guy is the coolest of all of us. What are you talking about?
You see him, he's the coolest.
See that guy? You know cool guys? He's the coolest.
You've heard of cool guys, haven't you? Well, he's the coolest one.
He's the coolest one. I will add a caveat. I went to an all-boys school and Johnny Nazarelli might not have done very well, but I do feel like if Stephanie Zanoni was in an all-girls school in Ireland, she probably would actually win that.
Yeah, she would.
You'd just be like, can I just throw my life down for you right now?
Fall asleep on your cheekbones.
Oh, can you imagine?
Yeah. I have a theory. I think Stephanie had a baby over the summer. I think that's what happened because she comes in so filled with like existential like moroseness and like she's so repellent to Johnny. She wants someone exactly like Johnny. He has a motorbike and a jacket. But she can't be near Johnny or the T-Beards.
Johnny's baby?
It was Johnny's baby and I think she is now the unofficial sister of that baby.
And it's got a little pink lady baby girl.
Yeah, I think she's been severely... Yeah, it's very common, especially in this time period.
My word, that is excellent. That's excellent headcanon.
Yeah.
I mean, it also speaks to the fact that Greece 1, which she'll be forever known as now.
Greece 1.
It was another one which we watched 200 times. And I was well into adulthood before I copped that most of the second half of that movie is a bit of a pregnancy scare.
Yeah.
That was, as a child, I was just like, funny songs and cool guys. It just didn't clock. I heard the words as they were being said, but I didn't know what that was about. And when she said, I'm not pregnant at the end, I was like, whatever that means.
Yeah.
We go together. You know.
So the thing about Grease 2 is that you have to look at it in the larger context of what it thought it was trying to do.
Mm.
And I think what it thought it was trying to do is establish Grease as a genre of movie.
Yeah.
And Grease is a genre of movie according to the things that it picked up from the last one. And it's obviously, because there was supposed to be originally like 6 movies and there was supposed to be a TV series.
Oh, I didn't realize
there
that.
Was a whole wider brand synergy plan for the Grease universe. One of them was called Son of Grease. And which is obviously Stephanie Zanoni's baby.
Oh my God.
And clearly what they have like, you know, boiled down and derived from the Grease franchise in making Grease 2 is that Grease movies are movies that are nostalgically about something that happened 20 years ago. So the first one was made in the 70s and it was about the 50s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was made in the 80s, about the 60s. So a Grease 3 coming out now would be about the year 2001.
I hate those things when people say that.
Like, I know, I hate myself for saying it.
No, but I think they're amazing. I love breaking my brain like that. Like someone mentioned that 1980 is closer to 1939 than it is to 2021.
Hate it.
I know, it's not good. Send it back.
Send it back. And so that's a key tenet of what a Grease movie is. And the other thing is that it's about a kind of an imagined nostalgic world that never really existed.
Yeah.
And in that world, all that matters is sex.
Yeah, and I suppose that kind of heuristic, you see that in The Wonder Years or That 70s Show, maybe Everybody Hates Chris as well. Shows which are explicitly about a time and a place as much as they are about the characters and the plot. And the thing about the first Grease is that it had songs for days. So it's just better on that level. And then secondly, it was kind of this massive sort of worldwide phenomenon. So I presume that they were following it up just because, well, we need to mint another one of these.
Mm.
But it didn't seem like it was interrogating what this time was actually like. Because, I mean, it's set in 1961, but it's still pretty much the exact same thing. You know, they mentioned that Kennedy's president. That's the only thing. Other than that, it's exactly the same. Things are going on. Some of the same actors, because, I mean, it's realistic enough that, like, 2 years after the first one, you'd have, you know, some of the same teachers and stuff. But then you've got Frenchie.
Frenchie makes me sad in this film.
She's showing up and she's just there. And she does the most astounding bit of exposition to start with. So Michael Carrington, played by Maxwell Caulfield.
Yeah.
Either one of those could be flipped and sound equally fake.
So true.
Yeah. He's like, doesn't matter. What's your real name? Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
It's even worse. He ended up in Emmerdale eventually. And I said that really like the way my dad said.
You really did.
Yeah. Do you know he was on Emmerdale last week. I was like, thank you for that, Daddy. You didn't need to ring me. I'm sweating because you only ring me whenever someone's died. But I'm glad that Frank Kelly from Father Ted is now in Emmerdale. Anyway, he is introduced because he is Sandy from the first film's cousin.
Yes.
So didn't need to do that. It's a gossamer thin thread from the last movie. But she sets it up with, like, it's about 90 seconds long and it's just information. Well, you know, since they've all gone away and I'm back, but here I am and I'm helping out, blah, blah, blah. I think she's like helping out. And
she wants to get, she dropped out and she wants to go back to get her chemistry thing so she can start a skincare line.
And you never see her again, apart from like little bits where he's like checking in about his woes with the wonderful Stephanie Zanoni.
Yeah.
But like, she's a real, it's a real support part. She could have filmed all of that in like one afternoon.
It does make me a little sad, particularly. And you always hear it's such a stalwart of sort of Hollywood script stories gone bad, which I love hearing, of like, oh, you know, this thing is like six drafts melded into one. And that is the Grease 2 story, isn't it? Because of all the drafts, there's a draft of Grease 2 that's about campishly poking fun at everything that made Grease 1 successful. So like blowing up all these like horny steaks to like a John Waters level of like fluorescent bizarre craziness, which is like do it for your country and reproduction.
Yeah.
And that's what that draft is doing. There's another draft that's like about, oh, following on from the legacy and all this, and like let's really sew in what the Grease world is all about and let's take this very seriously.
A literal expanded universe.
An expanded, yeah, which is what the sort of Frenchy stuff is doing. And then there's like all these like storylines that get like poked and nudged at with a stick. And it's like all of these drafts have been distilled into this sort of one mono draft where some of it is filled with the most colourful, bizarre, interesting, weird, catchy, brilliant moments. And some of it is like, what the fuck am I watching?
Yeah. And like also, you know, the threads of kind of like male longing and kind of possession and sort of, we'll say it again, horniness. That's there in Grease 1 as well.
Yeah.
It's absolutely there. And you can obviously wield that and have your cake and eat it and kind of address. That was kind of weird the way teenage boys acted back then, and won't it reflect on how teenage boys still act to this day? It doesn't really do that though. It's just like these guys are horny and it's fucking cool. Isn't it great how horny these guys? There's one song which, I mean, called Prowlin, which is like, it's just the three of them talking about how they're going prowlin with an apostrophe.
apostrophes are for cool guys.
Yeah, that's what I don't like about it.
That's where you draw the line.
Yeah. Syntax, grammar, spelling, please. And it's like a piss take of itself. Like, I could imagine that being in the John Waters version, only if they were then set up to be the villains of the piece or to get their comeuppance, to get even the sort of cream pie in the face that you sometimes saw in the first Grease. But they don't. They're all completely, they are the stars of the film, and it's just considered like a kind of a cool, catchy way of them describing how they're looking to go out and just be very lascivious and weird.
The first verse of Prowlin is just fucking them talking about, there's this girl at the butcher shop, and they're just like cited, like listing girls they've seen.
They're sacking all the peaches. She's the apple of my eye. I'm like, let's see what you did there. But it's also not a great song. That's the other thing.
The great songs in this are great. The skipovers remain skipovers. I think we're going to score tonight. Rocks.
Really, I do. And I actually think Score Tonight is one of the best examples of one which it has almost nothing to do with what's going on. It's not like, you know, one of those musicals which starts off with like, well, you know, I've always wondered about my taxes and then whatever. It's like it branches off. It's just like a song that is just dropped in.
Yeah.
You know, it's what's it called? Exegetic. It's in the actual thing. Like, they're at the bowling alley and then they all start singing and dancing and everything. You know, you suspend your disbelief about that. But it doesn't really move the story along. It doesn't do it. It's not. It's just all them saying they're going to score tonight at the bowling. But I presume they also just mean, like, kissing. But, like, they're all coupled up anyway. So,
yeah.
It's just like, we're in healthy relationships. It's like, all right, cool. Thanks for the status update.
Thank you.
It's not driving. There's no want there.
It is a funny thing because, like, that is supposed to be the sort of internal logic of musicals, isn't it? Is that the characters are singing feelings that are so strong they can't be said, right? Yeah. And every song should have an emotional reason. And very few of the songs in Grease 2 have an emotional reason for existing. It's just like, and I think a lot of that has to do, I want to be, you know, a woman supporting other women and everything, is that the director of Grease 2 is the choreographer of Grease 1, who is patently, like, not a director.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, this very esteemed choreographer on Broadway, but whenever you see her being interviewed, and I looked at a few things on YouTube, it's just her smoking a fag, being like, yeah, it's a great choreographer. Did some great choreo.
Well, there is some great choreography.
I know, but like, narratively.
No, it doesn't make sense. And also, like, the thing about that is, as well, if you're so steeped in that, like, it makes absolute sense. Grease is itself very stagey in places. But it's also a movie in between. This felt like a stage show that had, like, some movie elements.
Yeah.
So even down to the fact that the casting of every single person, like, even all the background players, I mean, I love them so much, like, watching the extras, because they're all theatre kids. And it doesn't matter if they're dressed up as greasers or nerds or jocks. It doesn't matter. They're all theatre kids. It's like when you see a kitten calendar and they're like, oh, he's a fireman on September. And he's
they're all kittens.
They're all kittens. They have all of the threat of, like, a Furby. Like, there's nothing there, really. Yeah. And it's really, really funny to watch them, especially the T-Bird goons, like the lower, just below Johnny, including Goose, played by Chris McDonald.
Oh.
Shooter McGavin. And
wait, who is that?
Shooter McGavin is from Happy Gilmore, I think.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And he's like, he's just kind of like, you know, Johnny Nazarelli will be talking, and the rest of them do that real Broadway thing where they're all like, you know, for listeners, I'm just kind of leaning forward so as to, like, kind of form a nice sort of almost like a proscenium arch around the character. And it's so brilliant because it's really fun to watch, but it completely jumps you out of the movie. Like, it's very stagey, and also means that if the song isn't good and the performance doesn't grab you, then, like, there's nothing really.
Yeah, it just feels very uncomfortable, which is that thing of, like, wow, there are these great moments in this movie, but also these moments where you're just like, who's asleep at the wheel here?
Do you like Reproduction, the song?
Yes, and yes. That was one of the parts that really, really worked for me. Because, again, it exists for no reason. And also, to link it back to that sort of John Waters thing, Tab Hunter is the supervised teacher who is singing the song. Why does it start again? It's like the most awkward sonic delivery ever. It's like,
he does the thing I was talking about. He's sort of, it's like Sprachgesangen. He starts off speaking, and then throughout their courses he's still saying, and everyone knows that the reproduction, he's speaking while they're all singing, which I think is actually still sounds really arresting and interesting.
It's very interesting
because it's not just sort of 50s diner kind of Americana kind of stuff.
It's him talking like this, reading from a book.
It's kind of a bit more like the B-52s or like Talking Heads.
It does feel like the B-52s. That's such an accurate thing. And, like, so he's Tab Hunter, but, like, he was in a John Waters movie like 3 years previously playing opposite Divine as Divine's husband. And he was a 50s heartthrob, and then John Waters, like, repurposed him as, like, this joke figure fun of that.
So this has almost actually gotten him the job here because
this is
such a John Waters character.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of stuffy, but you can absolutely tell that he's like a handsome man, but he's like playing a Clark Kent style fumbling guy with big glasses and a ridiculously big shirt, and you kind of detect a frisson between him and the very attractive
Miss Mason. Oh my God, I can't believe the two hottest blonde women who've ever lived are in this film. When do you get two at once?
Oh, I know.
Just like, because you got Michelle Pfeiffer, and it's like, wow, never has a fawn so delicate stumbled out of the woods in front of mine very eyes. Me, the clunky hunter. And then you get Miss Mason, who is like everything good you remember about Brigitte Bardot, but with none of the problems.
Yeah, and none of the lines.
She's just the hottest person ever. It's like huge helmet, blonde hair and these eyes, but like it just totally works.
And she does that kind of very 50s, early 60s movie thing of she's supposed to be kind of slightly airheaded, and you can tell because she walks like this. Like backwards and forwards, like a tiny little meerkat.
Yeah.
She gives a really characterful performance. I think she does really well. She knows what movie she's in, just like Blanche and the headmistress.
The two principal characters, yes.
They know what film they're in. Or actually, they're in a better film and they've just brought us into it every once in a while. Sid Caesar, the coach, I mean, it's amazing. But like all of the teen stuff, it's very hit and miss.
With the exception of Do It For Your Country.
Yes.
That song... Set it up for us. It is the most arresting teen love song.
So this is a weird sit for the com, but the basic premise is that one of the T-Birds, he really wants to...
Louis.
He wants to get to third base with his best gal.
Sharon.
Mm-hmm. Wow, you know all the names.
I watched a few times.
Did you actually?
I watched this movie once. I watched this clip on YouTube several times.
So basically, he finagles his way into a nuclear bunker or a mock nuclear bunker, which can be used for a bit of private time because no one's going to be around. Mm-hmm. And so he manages to, in song, convince Sharon that it would actually... not be unpleasant to have sex with him. Mm-hmm. It would actually be really cool, quite rad, and also extremely patriotic by singing, "We're going to do it for our country, the red, white, and the blue," because I believe they mock that an actual nuclear strike is happening by setting the alarms off.
Yeah. It's very japes.
Yeah, it's super japesy. And then, of course, it all collapses because his two mates are listening outside, like comedy, kind of like vaudeville comedians with the glass behind them, and then they stumble in. Which doesn't make sense either, but it's like a real Laurel and Hardy kind of thing. And then she's like, "Oh, you pig." And you're like, "Yeah, you are a pig. That's like ridiculous."
But here's the thing. I responded.
You're like, "Yeah, that's fair game."
Okay, so yeah, it's everything you just said it was. And it's this... first of all, I find that sort of like Cold War scare thing hot. Because this is the whole duck and cover era.
It is.
Of like nuclear threat. Is it
and came out in the 80s when that was all getting started again.
Yes. Yeah. So it must have felt throbbing. And so I find that era very romantic anyway. I don't know. I find that thing of like being a sort of a 60s teenager in a poodle skirt, but knowing that the world could collapse in on you.
Absolutely.
Like narratively compelling. And so the fact that they're in this sort of like desolate bunker, you know, compared to sort of pastels of the rest of their world. And his voice is beautiful.
Yeah.
It's the only like properly good vocal performance of the thing. And...
yeah,
he's like, "And I'll win this war for you," and you believe him.
And he's kind of, they're kind of, there's also that sort of rugged soldier thing where she's like dressing his arm, and then he's kind of sweaty, and they're just kind of young, not as young as they're actually billed to be, which we will get onto. I've got all of their ages written down if you want to know. But yeah, it does do that thing where it's balancing the horror of war, which has its own little hot dark side.
Yeah,
and then there is also just the sort of squeaky clean. Neat sort of poodle dresses. Like, I can see that is kind of, that's arresting, that's good.
Yeah, it's, and the song's hot. Good. He's hot also.
Interesting.
That's important.
You've got a Louis thing.
Yeah, gonna tell my grandkids that was Marianne Connell. Him and his vest, and she's just like, and the interesting thing about the song, like narratively as well, it's really clever and funny because like he's being like, you know, "I might go off to war and die tomorrow, so you better shag me," which is how men have been getting laid for centuries.
It's why wars were invented.
Why wars were invented, yeah. So people get laid. And and she's like, "Oh, you're going to war tomorrow," and she's thinking like very pragmatically about what war will involve. And he's just like, "Fuck me."
Yeah, really, genuinely.
Yeah, genuinely.
That is not an exaggeration because it flipped and she is convinced so quickly.
And then the reason she runs out is because she's signing them up for the war effort. So good.
It is. And also...
And this whole thing of like, Uncle Sam will approve, your mother will approve, the country will approve. It's hot.
Well, it's a bit like that old, the sort of back and forth that happens every year about Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Yes.
And then there's the feminist, the original feminist reading, and then there's the post reading, which is actually, this is at a time when women had very little agency to openly accept.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Offers of a sexual nature. Yeah. And what this is, the whole song is actually doing, it's him giving her the agency and the license to say, oh, it's cold outside. So yeah, she's playing along with it. It's a playful thing. I read a fantastic...
I totally agree with that reading.
The other one is, it's not, he's not stopping her. You can hear in the performance of the voice, because it's not a poem. It's not written down. It's a performance where she's playfully saying, oh, well, I suppose I wouldn't want to get cold. That's what it is. And it's the same thing here where she clearly also wants to have sex with a cool, hot, sweaty guy. She's just being given completely, you know, I'd say unforgivably, but she's being given a justification. And you can tell that because in like 19 seconds later, she's like, okay, cool. Well, yeah, let's go.
Like, I think that, like, you know, obviously it's become, I find it very, very frustrating because, yes, there are lots of like, problems in media.
Really? I've not heard about
these. I've not heard about these. What are these problems? And you know, the stuff that's like really insidious and really bothers me, and rape culture and all that stuff, and like, and really does just sort of fly under the radar and has these really insidious moments in culture. And it's important we isolate and talk about them, but I also feel like pointing out like potentially problematic material and then just ending your sort of discussion of the piece there is very stupid and robs the work of its own cheekiness and its own knowledgeability about what it's doing. And everyone on screen knows what it's a very weirdly like artistic moment from Grease 2.
Yeah. And also you kind of, I mean, I struggle with this where you kind of, you don't want to become so anti-problematic that you become a prude.
Yeah. Are we like sort of turning ourselves into a nation of Helen Lovejoys, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing, it's so funny that, you know, you mentioned about, you know, rape culture and patriarchy. But one of the things that patriarchy has also done is it has completely removed from almost all culture the idea of women who are also sexual.
Yeah.
Particularly, you know, younger women and, you know, geez, in Ireland, that's the entire story of the 20th century and many centuries before. So there is definitely room for nuance on it. And I think Stephanie Zanoni, our dear beloved Stephanie Zanoni, she's a really good example where her central stated issue, not her headcanon baby.
Thank you for indulging the headcanon baby.
It's not, we have a shared headcanon for that. It's not actually that scrutable. Like, it's kind of, she's a bit salty about life. She doesn't like Johnny anymore, but you're not really sure what's motivating her, except that she imbues it with a sort of wounded, just an iffiness about everything that's going on. And because she's such a good actress and a mesmerizing, charismatic performer, you kind of think, yeah, I can totally imagine a headcanon baby, or I can totally imagine that she has had sex and she didn't enjoy it and she wants to break out of things. She definitely seems more worldly.
Yeah, she absolutely does.
And her worldliness isn't, it's not even presented as the way Rizzo's is in the first one.
Yeah.
Where it's almost like fallen woman kind of thing. You know, we grew to love Rizzo in the thing, but she even declares herself that, you know, she has a whole song about all the bad things she's done. And with Stephanie, it's like, we don't even have to say that stuff. She's just badass, cool as hell, and absurdly beautiful, cool person.
Yeah, and just like wordlessly self-possessed in a way that isn't in the dialogue at all, but just like Pfeiffer is bringing to the role.
Yeah, and she's 20.
Oh, she's 20.
And I think she'd been in like one or two things. I think she was kind of did ads and stuff like that, and she was a beauty queen.
Yeah.
But like, just in such an assured performance.
And that whole thing with Cool Rider, right? Like, which I think, like, I posted about this on Instagram, and like so many women just like fucking a wall of Cool Rider came back. And I do think like a lot of women just saw Stephanie Zanoni straddling that ladder and like, oh, that's who to be.
Yeah.
And it's, you could be worse things to aspire to.
Or had a sexual awakening, or had, yeah, you know, that some, it was, it, things like that and Do It For Your Country, they pop out of this film because, as you say, they are, it's like they're from the best version of this movie.
Where, yes.
I mean, I don't even think Cool Rider is that amazing. It's not an amazing vocal performance necessarily.
No.
But it's like a real right-hand turn in the middle of the film. It's like, yeah, wow, okay. She's just like walking. It's not in a sort of, she's on her own, first of all. There's very few solo songs in this one. And she's just like using props and straddling things. And she's delivering so much of her I want,
yeah,
just in this one song, that she doesn't really in the rest of the dialogue. She's just kind of sort of aloof and cool and sort of like smoking in every sense. you know, she just kind of is, she's just rebel TM, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas this, that delivers so much of her kind of personality, even though afterwards you go back and you read it and like, you read the lyrics or you listen to it again, you're like,
the lyrics are nothing.
She, yeah, just wants a guy who's got a motorbike.
That's it. That is the whole
it's
deal.
It's the subtext, it's the text, it's everything.
Totally. And when you go back to what you said earlier on about how the calendar of kittens, of like, no matter what you put these actors in, they look like theatre kids.
Yeah.
And they sound like theatre kids. And that's part of the slightly more alienating parts of the movie. But because Michelle Pfeiffer, she has no singing or dancing experience.
Really? Okay. That checks out.
Yeah. And except for she just liked to sing and liked to dance. And so it's almost like there was nothing for her to unlearn to do this performance. And so you see her doing that Cool Rider thing, and she's like, she gets that, because it's all happening backstage at a theater for this talent show. They're all inexplicably, that's another version of this movie from Rejected Script, yeah, is that it's all hinged on a talent show.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's like, and that's a fairly,
it's a lot of screen time,
long period of the movie.
And she sort of leaves the sort of backstage area, and she sort of starts dancing out, and she starts kind of shuffling her feet, pointing them in and out and in and out and walking, and it should not work.
No, but it does somehow. Does. Yeah. You mentioned theatre kids. Can I tell you the ages of the characters?
Oh yeah, please. That is like, if we're talking about Grease as a genre of film, having incredibly old people play 17-year-olds.
So in ascending order of age, well, first of all, there's Pamela Adlon.
I know, Bobby Hill.
Bobby Hill. And she's in like Louie and a few other sort of sitcom-y,
yeah,
bits.
Love her. I'm so happy to see her.
Amazing. She was actually 15 when she,
okay,
made,
so Pamela Adlon is the youngest Pink Lady, the Pink Lady in Training.
She's, yeah. I mean, again, what are the,
what are they setting her up for?
But also,
just to fuck Johnny Nagarelli.
Everybody take a step to the right. She's, yeah, it's like, what bureaucracy is happening here where they have to, like, do you have to fill out a form? Do you have, yeah, to do 2 years? Is it like a provisional license?
It's very like, did you ever go to Irish College?
I never did.
Oh, because you lived in an Irish college. And but like, you'd have like Kayleys every night, and just whoever you kind of ended up with, you'd end up scoring. that's the team.
Yeah,
Pink
or
Lady.
Like all the boys in one end of the room and the girls the, yeah, other end, and then the maddest lad would kind, yeah, of go into the middle, and then slowly but surely, yeah.
Yeah, and all the height-appropriate people would just match up.
I think in the last 14 seconds, we have just revealed why they could never make an American version of, or an Irish version of Grease.
Yeah.
Just be very, very quiet. nothing, people would be walking
Irish
everywhere.
Irish version of Grease is just called Feet.
Yeah.
it's an Irish college doing a Kayleigh.
And walking everywhere because they didn't have motorcycles. And like staying indoors because it was raining all the time. Okay, so she is 15. She plays Dolores. She's
okay.
A very charming performance. She's actually very good.
Lovely.
So, upwards from that, this is like the main cast, the people that you'd know. Maxwell Caulfield,
yeah,
stroke Michael Carrington, is 21.
Yes.
So he's close to age appropriate. I suppose they're supposed to be, what, 17 or 18?
Yeah. And he looks age appropriate.
Okay. Michelle Pfeiffer is actually 23, not 20, as I said.
Wow.
I mean, then it starts to really accelerate. So Johnny is 27 at the time.
Johnny Nasher, yeah. I mean, he looks 55.
I don't have Louis.
that like Just for Men black hair in the quiff, it ages up, young man.
Yeah. Goose, Chris Middleton, he's actually 26, so I'll beat him. But the high priest of it is Leo Belmudo, Craterface, from the first movie.
Craterface!
Who is 36.
Yeah. I mean,
is he
yeah.
supposed to be a co... Like, does he go to a different school? Or is he just an adult that's messing with these teenagers for no reason?
He just rocks up to a school to threaten them on his motorbike.
I haven't
seen... Craterface has a bike now. He had yeah, a car in the last movie.
Like, imagine if you're 16 or 17 years old and, like, your arch nemesis is, like, Michael Parkinson on a bike. It's like, how did they even run into each other? What's...
Leave me alone.
What, stop, please. Oh, no. It's Melvin Bragg is coming after me.
No, but there is that version. You know, when you're, like, 14 and you go to, like, to the corner shop or something and, like, there's, like, 17-year-olds hanging out bullying you. And even then, you're like, why... Yeah. I am 14.
I shouldn't even register on your radar.
No, yeah, I should be nothing to you. Stop.
Like, and they're talking like everything that they came and they come and they trashed the end of school kind of luau. Which, yeah. by the way, I didn't get have one of those in my school.
You didn't have that at your grads, no?
No,
you didn't have a luau at the grads.
Like, they come and they trash it up. It was like, imagine if that was what you were doing. You're 35. You're in a biker. You're 35 and you look about 500. By the way,
headcanon, creative faces in them.
Oh.
No, too early for Nam. Korean War? Yeah. I like America.
Yeah. I know all the history. But yeah, why it doesn't, that's never really set up, and it's completely tacked on to give it a little bit of continuity from the first, and also to have a baddie, I guess. But like, they're in so little screen time, and their involvement makes absolutely no sense. And they're also kind of, they come and they go, and it's all sorted very quickly. It's like a real paper tiger of a villain.
And it's so they are there, so Michael Carrington can prove himself. Which actually something I wanted to ask you about, because I've, you know, as a woman, I've grown up with the sort of the makeover narrative, the nerdy girl to the hot girl, take off her glasses. Wow. What's it like being a young guy watching one of the few male makeover movies? There really aren't that many. I can't really think of any. Of like nerd to cool guy.
I suppose it's kind of, I mean, it's actually referenced in the text. But like the Superman Clark Kent thing is one, I suppose. And then also the flip of that would be Peter Parker and Bruce Wayne and stuff. But that doesn't really work, because they are both the same person either way.
It's not the same because they're choosing to do that to like they're hiding their...
Well, it's basically a reverse Sandra Dee, which makes sense because he's the cousin, and that's just what that family does. They change
they
everything
change
about themselves.
They change at the drop of a hat.
They change everything about themselves for the person that they're in love with.
Yeah.
But it is interesting because I never really thought about it that way. I kind of think that's quite a brave bit of the text. Also, it's complicated by the fact that I don't think anyone could ever possibly judge him for doing that, because I would lay down in traffic to basically just get to sit very close to Stephanie Zanoni.
Yeah.
I mean,
just to do, when they do their chemistry is awful, I think.
Yeah, it's not great.
That kiss that they have at the end.
It's like two chairs kissing.
It's like semi-professional porn actors, which is the hideous line between professional porn actors and absolute amateurs who are doing it for fun. The semi-pros are the grimmest ones.
They're too inside their own heads.
They're in their own heads. And it's like they do that kiss, that the end of movie kiss that teens, kiss on the lips. But then they just kind of keep going in a way that it feels like it's supposed to devolve into a weird, awkward sex scene.
He also does that thing that kind of, I think, more of a 40s, 50s movie star thing where he kind of like pinches her chin while he's kissing her.
Yeah.
And it's like, it seems so, it seems patronizing almost. I mean, because obviously you can see movies where maybe they do that and you don't even notice because there's charisma there. But without it, it just seems like he's like, little porcelain doll. Here we go, little smackaroo. But I remember being very, in my younger days, being very taken with their relationship, because I was like, God, he's realized that the secret is just to be as cool as possible. So to answer your earlier question, I think it did burrow into me. It was like, okay, this is the thing that girls like. Because I then extrapolated from that all girls obviously like motorbikes or whatever.
Yeah.
So that was never an option. So I was like, I could just actually just be as cool as possible. And I think all boys do that kind of thing. I remember definitely walking around with, this is, I cannot believe I'm saying this in public, but...
Oh my God.
Yeah, in my school uniform. So, sex on legs already.
Love it. What colour? Maroon?
No,
navy?
Not too bad. It was black with white shirt, but I wore a grey shirt because...
Slimming.
I don't give a fuck about anything.
Yeah.
And also slimming. How dare you? And I had... I'd always have like something ridiculously bouncy, like sticking out of my little blazer pocket, like a L'Étrange by Albert Camus something like that. Yeah, I mean, sexual dynamite, obviously.
Love it.
As if someone was just going to run across Guildhall Square and say, excuse me, sorry, I just saw that you're the sexiest man I've ever seen. Can we please like go steady? But that was kind of, and that was me doing a Michael, I suppose. And like, you know, it does seem strange that I haven't seen more movies where someone does that. I mean, yeah. I suppose you could say that all of those Bergerac kind of knockoffs where it's the nerdy guy is getting advice from the hot guy and it's like in an earpiece or he's like, that's kind of the same thing maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not really. Like, he's literally putting on a... Oh, by the way, he learns to be an amazing motorcyclist very quickly.
Well, it's over the course of a school year.
I still say that's quite quick.
Quick, yeah.
He's better than everybody else. He's like beating them. He's like doing all these fancy tricks and they're like, hey, we got to get this guy, boss.
Hey, we got to get this guy.
Hey, we're just setting up whatever it is you're about to say. Doink. You know, like they're always doing all this stage school stuff.
Why are they always so quasi-Italian?
Yeah, that is also true. The greasers.
Is like right out high in Queens? Like,
well, that's the thing. It's in California, I think.
Right.
But I don't know if it's ever actually stated, but I think it was filmed in like 3 or 4 different California high schools. Mm-hmm. The Rydell High scenes. And it's based on the original writer, who hates Grease 2, by the way, hates it and was very upset he wasn't involved. It's based on his experiences in a California high school in the 50s.
Right.
Which, I mean, in what sense based on his experiences, I'm not sure because...
Well, here's the thing. As someone who writes young adult novels and therefore spends a lot of time thinking about my own teens, you do remember the horny stuff the most. Do you remember being horny? You remember being frustrated?
Yeah. And it's one of those things that's really... I mean... You mentioned it earlier about Marion and Connell in Normal People. Like, that's one of the things, particularly in the TV show, when you're seeing it on screen, you remember an awful lot of very embarrassing things that you wouldn't understand, you wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, when you're seeing it on screen. I don't really get that with Grease because it's so huge and large. It doesn't really hit me back to my... It hits me back to my childhood watching Grease 2. It doesn't...
Yes.
It has nothing...
There are no attendant memories.
It has nothing to do with my own experience of... my teenage years. Anyway, it's my experience of being like 8 to about 13 and watching this movie way, way more than is advisable.
I love that your family, because your family is so large, that it's big enough to form a consensus.
Yeah.
And in the consensus of that universe, this is a classic film.
Yeah, well, I mean, barely even consensus. I'd say dogma. Like it was a diktat. Like this was just one of the, it was one of the stars of the Hollywood firmament, you know? The Gnomobile was another one, which nobody has seen. The Gnomobile. It's about gnomes that drive a car.
Well,
yeah,
that title's doing a lot of heavy lifting for it. The one in our family that me and my siblings loved was the TV movie of the Bruce Lee story starring Brandon Lee.
Oh, wow.
In which we were obsessed with this. Brandon Lee has, you know, on-screen sex with the woman who plays his mother. And then in the next scene, she's pregnant. So he conceives himself. Which is the ultimate male fantasy, I think.
Wow.
It's a great movie. It's not good. But as far as I was concerned, until I was in my like 20s, I thought this was a movie. It was like Scarface. It was like a movie everybody had seen and knew about.
Isn't it interesting? I mean, we obviously having those 800 videos meant we had quite a wide diet. But also my dad recorded very strange things. We had like Wurzel Gummidge Down Under, you know.
What did he get up to?
I can't remember, but we definitely watched it several times. But we had... Like, and my dad also recorded loads of like religious oriented programming, like sort of the investiture of Catholic bishops if they were on TV.
Important stuff. And also, do you have that great thing of like having stuff taped off the TV? So it also means the adverts are stuck in your head.
The best thing in the world.
Yeah.
So like loads of Camels serving harp or Papa Nicole.
Here's the thing with these Brits, we'll never know. Is that?
Oh no! Wait! Don't tell them.
Don't tell. I've gotten 50 minutes into the podcast. They deserve to know. Is that Irish ads have the best music ever.
Yeah.
Fucking Pat the Baker, man.
So fresh, it's famous.
It's so good.
And also they have an attitude to graphic design, which I would describe as...
maverick.
Yeah. yeah. Like, they were well ahead of the game in terms of that ad, which is just the card for the place, some music, and someone saying, come down to Castletown Roach for the spinning wheel. And it's just a business card. So you couldn't even film something.
Yeah.
Like, that predominated throughout my childhood. They've kind of gone away, I think, those ads now.
Oh, no, they're still in Cork. This is way off topic. There's a cinema in Cork that's on North Main Street. And the first thing that you hear when you sit in the cinema is, North Main Street! Full of shops, restaurants, markets, the works.
See, and now I know all about it.
Now you're going to go?
Yeah.
Okay, we should wrap up for today. But you have a book out about your very large and charming family.
I do. It's called Grease 2, The Everlasting Journey. No, it's called Did You Hear Mommy Died? You were actually one of the very first people to ever read any of this.
Yeah.
For that book event a few years ago. Yes, it's way funnier than that title, Did You Hear Mommy Died? Sounds. It's about my childhood up to about the age of 11. Grease 2 might not get a mention, but there's a whole chapter just about my dad's video collection, which I think people will enjoy. And yeah, I've heard from several people that it's probably the best book.
It's probably the best book, I think.
You know books, it's the best one.
You've heard of books.
Yeah.
Get ready to meet the best one.
Someone got to do it one time.
Yeah.
He did it.
Yeah. I. It is really good. I think you are Ireland's new David Sedaris, personally. I think that's what's in for you. I think you just need to just be gay now, please.
Guys. Well, I'll get working. Stephanie Zanoni is not helping.
But in terms of like... hearing about people's families is a bit like hearing people's dreams. It's like, I'm not in this. No matter how long you talk for, I'm never going to be in it.
I know. And also, I have to, I kind of, the sort of top down story of the book is my mum died when I was very little, when I was 5. And my dad brought up 11 kids by himself on the border during the Troubles. So there's loads of bits there that could be quite Frank McCourted up and made quite miserable. But the kind of the game and also just the only way that I would be able to write it is by... making it filled with jokes, mainly because that's just the way I write, and secondly because it's true. Like, the things were really, really funny. It was absolutely absurd. You know, the title of the book is because I was greeting people at my mum's wake saying, did you hear Mommy died? Because I just thought it was the news of the day.
Is there anything else about Grease 2 we want to say? We didn't even talk about the talent show where she zones out and sees his dead body and he's a ghost biker.
Yeah.
And he's like, keep me alive, Stephanie.
Yeah, that one was, again, very John Watersy. Like...
That one knew what it was doing.
Absolutely. But it's also, it's too self-serious to be camp and too camp to be self-serious. It is kind of caught between two sides of the ladder straddled.
It's the mystery of Grease 2. You can't tell when they mean it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which makes it like when I was watching it that first time, baffling, but also means I'm going to come back to it.
I can't believe you've never seen it before. That's actually the biggest surprise to me.
I know, I love crap.
Yeah, but
I'm the queen of it.
Also, it's the highest rated film of all time.
Yeah,
so.
Of course. You've heard of films? This is the best one. Anyway, we gotta go. They're gonna charge me for the extra hour. Bye, Seamus. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you for having me.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's CZAROLINE, or email me about the podcast at sentimentalpod@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thank you to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the artwork, and Hannah Varro for the mixing.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.